The next matter, number 252087 and number 252088, Justin Urban versus Zurich American Internet Insurance Company. At this time, would counsel for the appellant cross-appellee Urban please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Richard Sullivan for Justin Urban, the appellant, and one matter, that being the offset issue and the cross-appellee and the two issues raised by my brother and sister. As a result, I'd ask that if I could possibly indulge the court to reserve 5 minutes, because I have to address two of their issues.
How about three?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's the appellant's position that the district court erred by granting Zurich's offset. This is a case that arises out of Mass General Laws Chapter 193A, and it's triggered by the 1989 amendment that damages awarded under Mass General Law 93A are not reduced by the amount paid to satisfy the judgment and underlying claims. That's been the case law since 2001 under the R.W. Granger & Sons JS installation at page 84. Standard review is de novo, so the appeal, this court owes no deference to the lower court, and that's a result of Bunker Hill versus J. Williams, 94 Mass Appellate Court, 572 at 574. Given the defendant the credit for the amount paid to the plaintiff to satisfy underlying judgment and underlying claims would contravene the legislature's intent to impose a stiff penalty under General Law 93A. The defendant who knowingly or willfully fails to settle a claim will liably an underlying claim is clear. Again, Granger at 84. Settlements of the underlying claims do not reduce 93A damages because underlying claims are separate and distinct from the 93A claim. In this case, the judgment was paid by Zurich, but because of the original claim, where this was a unique case in that it was tried during COVID to a jury of three judges, one sitting as issues of law, and all three sitting to make decisions as a jury as to the facts. And in that case, that panel found a 90% liability on the defendants. As a result, Zurich paid as to the named defendant, Mr. Weston, and that's the underlying verdict. In this case, after the court ruled and doubled, Judge Kelly doubled the verdict as pursuant to the statute, my brother and sister asked for reconsideration. And we suggest the court was mistaken or misled when they had the autocraft case suggest them, because that was not a case that it was the 1989 amendment. That was a case that involved a fine. And so it is clear that as to the measure of damages, there should have been no offset. If I may go on and address
On R.W. Granger, your primary case, isn't that about and the offset for damages paid by a guarantor? So isn't that a different scenario than we have here?
No, Your Honor. I would suggest that the question, in fact, in Granger, the question, well, who was it paid? The distinction, because the 1989 amendment, is that, again, Zurich paid because they had a duty on Mr. Weston because of their contract. This claim, and what Judge Kelly found, was they acted in knowing bad faith. And the statute under the 1989 amendment says you shall double. And again, the emphasis was this was the legislative intent was to punish. And so that it made it clear that there was no offset for the underlying payment. So I would disagree, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me ask you about part of the cross appeal. So there's an argument that the district court didn't do the analysis correct in terms of the offer that was made on your 93A claim. Can you just walk through how you think that analysis is supposed to work? How should a court decide whether the offer is reasonable?
But I would like to point out to the court that, as we've stated in our brief, we believe that the appellants have failed to meet the standard here because they gave you no factual, they did not attach any transcripts, no factual record. And the standard being that it was said should be clear and erroneous as to what the judge did. But what she did, I believe, Your Honor, was that, and this is laid out in the 150-plus paragraphs of her decision, what she suggested was that she made it certain that June of 2018, liability became reasonably clear.
Well, I'm sorry, counsel, I'm asking more about the safe harbor issue. So the underlying liability.
But I apologize. So in order to, I believe because she made that finding, that as a result, when she took the safe harbor, the defendants came up with this imaginary $500,000 amount being reasonable. And they tried in their safe harbor, in their original, in the letter when they presented it after a demand, they represented that this was based on going back to the date of a mediation where they had this false, it would take $500,000, and they took the loss interest expectation, and they said that the reasonable interest would be 6%. If you took those months, I believe that was roughly 24 months, that as a result, that $70,000 would be the loss of use for that $500,000. This is a case that involves a judgment. Our demand was $2.84 million. That was doubling of the judgment, which was the standard, and the statute says, shall double, may treble. So that we suggest in the first part of it as a fiction, when they came up with this $500,000 value, but if you just accept their value in the first place, and which the judge did not, that's why her finding that it was not October, but June, because you had those additional 4 months, and even if you took their 6%, if you divide that, I believe that was 32 months, and it comes down to 16, and that would make it, under their formula, $80,000 would be a safe harbor.
What I'm struggling a little bit with, like, counsel on this is, it's not apparent to me that we really have any rationale from the district court on this point. It kind of goes along and says, I'm going to give my explanation, and then that section stops and it moves on. So it isn't entirely clear to me that we know what happened or what any rationale was or what a reasonable interest rate would be. So I appreciate you kind of walking us through math, but I'm wondering, isn't that something for the district court to explain to us first before we make that leap?
Again, Your Honor, I think unless it is clearly wrong, that is not the burden. But the issue is this, I would suggest that if you take any measure, so if you just take what the defendants are saying, they lose. If you take, in this case, the judge and her findings, if you looked at that, she found a reasonable rate of interest was 12%. Now, ironically, one of the cases that they cite, and its name escapes me right now, but it's a case that they argued. In that case, that insurer, when they're arguing for it, they're doing the same type of formula. They use 12%, the exact rate that the judge found. So if you take that in no way, if you can, in taking the light most favorable to defendants under any scenario, because they gave you nothing to go back and look at her record, if you can take any scenario, they fail. Because under their, because constant being that she said it was clear as of June of 18, not October, their safe harbor was too little. If you take their own position, that's 12%, it was less than half of what the value should be. If you take our position in the Granger's case position, that because it's a judgment, it's not the lost interest on the money when it became reasonably clear, it's to punish, it's the judgment itself. As a result of that, a reasonable value, again, if they use their 6%, would be well over $500,000. Under no scenario can they suggest that anything about the judge's finding was unreasonable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee, cross appellant, please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Lincoln Rose on behalf of the defendant appellee and cross appellant, Zurich American Insurance Company. Your Honors, this court must reverse the district court's order and find in favor of Zurich on Urban's Chapter 93A/176D claim, as the district court erred in holding that liability was reasonably clear despite Mr. Urban's comparative negligence. Here, there's no disputing that Mr. Urban was comparatively negligent. The underlying judicial panel found that he was comparatively negligent, and the district court itself held that Urban violated Chapter 90 for exceeding a speed that accounted for the heavy traffic at the time of the accident. Thus, the district court also noted that Urban's comparative negligence was relied upon by Zurich in its liability analysis. Thus, this defense was raised by Zurich, and both the underlying judicial panel as well as the district court both found that Mr. Urban was comparatively negligent. So against
but
this
fact, there's certainly a finding of comparative negligence, but what I'm wondering is whether that's enough. I think the district court also went on to say that essentially Zurich didn't really explore the issue very much to determine what that comparative negligence percentage might look like. And I don't understand you, though you could correct me, to be challenging any of the factual findings made by the district court on the point. So is a mere fact of an ultimate finding of comparative negligence enough, or don't we need to credit the district court's determination that, yes, there is going to be some comparative negligence, but there wasn't any reasonable dispute over what that would be because Zurich didn't explore the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The fact that there was an ultimate finding of comparative negligence is enough to insulate Zurich from Chapter 176D liability here.
That seems to be a bit further than most of the cases seem to go. It seems that there have been instances in which there was comparative negligence, but that wasn't alone enough to forestall liability.
Well, here, Your Honor, it was enough because, again, this goes to damages and whether damages was reasonably clear, and where the fact of at the time, again, this was at the time of Zurich's investigation, and at that time, the percentage of comparative negligence was not clear. That was in dispute.
But counsel, it just seems that your argument is that unless the insurance company knows exactly what the percentage of negligence attributed to the plaintiff here would be, that damages were not reasonably clear. And that seems inconsistent with Massachusetts case law, which I think says repeatedly, you don't need to know the exact amount that you're going to owe. As long as you have a pretty good sense of what it is, it's become reasonably clear. It's not crystal clear. It's reasonably clear is the language. So here, I believe there were internal analyses saying that if the van was moving at the time, then it would be the fault of the party that you insured, which means more than 50% fault, et cetera. And your client's initial offers were a tiny fraction of the ultimate damages to the plaintiff in terms of the harm, which I don't think was really disputed, right? It was clear what his medical injuries and his wages lost were. So aren't you really arguing for a crystal clear standard rather than reasonably clear, which is what the case law provides?
No, Your Honor. In a couple points, regarding your comment regarding the offers, this court has held that this is essentially an art, and in terms of negotiation, it does not call for the best and final offer, but there is a range of offers, and so all that's called for is an initial reasonable offer, and we're not arguing for a crystal clear standard. Again, it needs to And this goes to the damages, not to the fault. Remember, under 176D, in order for liability to be reasonably clear, it encompasses both fault and damages. And while fault may have been ascertained, the percentage of damages attributable to Mr. Weston was never reasonably ascertained due to the issue of Mr. Urban's comparative negligence.
But the cases go a little bit further and say that there has to be a legitimate difference of opinion on that point. And I guess that's what I'm getting to, and I think Judge Ruckelman is getting to as well, is that it doesn't seem to me on this record that there's much to support a legitimate difference of opinion on that point. There was going to be some, but the district court found that Zurich essentially kind of ignored that issue, didn't really develop it. There wasn't a record of, you know, it could be this large percentage, and so it wasn't subject to a reasonable dispute.
It was subject to a reasonable dispute where Mr. Urban was attributing all the blame to Zurich's insured, and Zurich was attributing some of the blame to Mr. Urban. So this was a dispute over was it comparative negligence, and if so, how much. So ultimately, that would insulate us from 176D liability here, where that was an open, open question.
The counsel, wasn't the initial offer, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, something like $100,000, which would, again, given that the actual harm to the person on the motorcycle was not disputed, would suggest that he was 90% responsible. And again, where was there reasonable information, or where was there data that was available to the insurance company suggesting that attributing 90% of the fault to him was a reasonable assessment of the situation, such that your offer was, you know, fair, prompt, equitable?
Again, to reiterate, Your Honor, all that's again, the final offer is not the best and final offer is not due by the insurer at the opening of a negotiation. And under 176D, courts have looked to whether a fair offer was made, whether the insurer has derailed the settlement process or it has participated in good faith. And here, Zurich made an initial offer and then made additional offers and attended two mediations. So where it, you know, voluntarily agreed to these processes of mediation as well as increased offers, it never derailed the settlement process. So therefore, while the initial offer and all its offers were reasonable, additionally.
Okay, let me ask you this way. Can you point us to anything in the record that would have supported the insurance company concluding that the person on the motorcycle was more than 50% at fault, that there was a reasonable dispute of opinion about that?
Your Honor, regarding in the record, it goes to his unreasonable rate of speed at the time of the accident, where the percent, I believe the speed was between 30 and 40 miles per hour through the intersection.
So the speed is what you would point to?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Additionally, I want to address Your Honor's point, questions regarding safe harbor and comments. Your Honor, there were multiple errors in the court's safe harbor analysis. As Your Honor pointed out, there is not much analysis there where it says for the reasons that follow and then delves into a separate section on damages for the found violation of 176D. There are a couple main errors here. First, the court notes that damages under 93A can include other forms of damages, such as fear of financial ruin, as well as being forced to litigate. However, what the court failed to recognize is that in a demand letter, the claimant has to set forth all relief sought, and any relief not mentioned is foreclosed as a matter of law. And as my brother pointed out, he sought double the amount of the underlying judgment. None of those categories of miscellaneous damages, such as fear of financial ruin or being forced to litigate, were sought by them. So then they shouldn't be considered, as the court seemed to do in its decision. However, the most egregious error the court made was that it conflated and considered the offers made to settle the underlying tort claim with the safe harbor offer. These are separate claims. And as the Massachusetts Court, Appeals Court recognized in Chiluli, settling the underlying tort claim does not necessarily resolve the 93A claim. So the court was wrong to conflate those, to consider those offers in determining whether Zurich's safe harbor offer was reasonable. The only offer that should have been considered was Zurich's safe harbor offer of $70,000. It should have been considered under the loss of use calculus that other courts, such as the district court in Wallstrom and in Gretzky, considered.
Could you talk a little bit about Calandro and clarify what the measure is for the reasonableness of that offer for purposes of the safe harbor? Because is it loss of use as opposed to the entire underlying claim and judgment?
Yes, because you have to remember, Your Honor, that at the time this offer was made, suit had not been filed yet. There was no finding of 93A liability against Zurich. So the loss of use calculus would apply in these circumstances, where at the time Zurich made its offer, there was no bad faith litigation and no finding that there was of 93A liability or that it was willful or knowing. So loss of use calculus would apply to the safe harbor offer, and it would be considered under consider the following factors. Your Honor, I see I'm about to run out of time. If I may finish, it should be considered the amount of money that should have been paid, when the money should have been paid and what interest rate should have been used. And all that's required under the law is a fair rate of interest. In Wahlstrom, the court held that 3.39% interest was a fair rate of interest and used it, the district court's judgment rate as a guidepost for considering that. And the last point I want to mention, Your Honor, is that this would this should be decided by this court under a de novo standard of review, where the court, where the underlying court made mistakes of state law in considering the offer. And with that, I'll rest and ask that the decision be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record? He has 3 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Richard Sullivan for Justin Urban. Your Honor, you addressed it exactly. The defendants are asking you to set a new standard in Massachusetts in this circuit. The controlling case since 2001 has been Hopkins versus Liberty Mutual. And that was a case where there was a five-vehicle accident. And the holding was where the insured was driving a car in the middle of the pileup. Despite the clear potential for fault to be attributed to people other than the insured, including the plaintiff, the court rejected the insurer's argument that liability was not reasonably clear and the chain reaction nature of the collision. Again, the plaintiff does not dispute the fact that the trial court and the district court both found that 10%, that my client had some comparative negligence, but minimal 10%. And what the court then went on to find out, Judge Kelly said, again, and if you look at the supplemental appendix, Carroll and Murray, that was the defense attorney and the claims representative, were the Zurich witnesses who testified on whether liability was reasonably clear. And the trial court rejected their testimony, which the district court was free to do. The court finds that neither Carroll nor Murray's testimony credible as to their reasons for banning an action of reconstructionists. The representation of an expert would not add value to clarity to the issues of liability. Neither witness rationale for abandoning the accident reconstruction, nor their efforts to discredit the value of an expert during liability was credible. As a result, again, that's why Her Honor found that liability was clear after the last deposition, which was completed in May of 2018. At the defendant's deposition, he admitted he hadn't looked for 10 seconds before down the lane my client was coming in, which he had the right of way, the light was with him, and that he also, that the witness, distance witness, Ms. Richards, testified that one, that Mr. Weston suggested throughout the case, and the defense that was clear throughout the judge's findings, that Mr. Murray, on behalf of Zurich, said, if the truck was moving, liability is an issue because of the general law that you must give way to the person who has the right of way. And what happened was, is that because of those factors, she found that the June 18th, after Ms. Richards testified, the truck was moving and the accident happened on his side, the southbound side of the roadway, close to the, it's a two lanes on that side and close to the right lane of the southbound way. As a result, Her Honor Judge Kelly found that's why she chose May 18th, the day that was, but no later than that time, as to when liability became clear. Further, as to the issue of the value, again, the supplemental appendix, if we go to page 20, paragraph 142, Judge Kelly said, Zurich was aware early on the severe injuries Urban suffered. An email sent to other Zurich personnel on December 18th of 2014, Mr. Murray described, can I finish, Your Honor?
Yes.
Described Urban's injuries as catastrophic and estimated the medical costs to be alone to be at least in the range of $250,000. In her findings, she also went on to say that Zurich had identified the case in 2017 as having a value of $1,006,000. And that's why she found that they were not reasonable offers that had been presented. And that is at page 30. I apologize, I believe it's 39 of the supplemental appendix. Page 39. Zurich's estimated this case was $1,006,500 to 17. Zurich was also aware that the Urban accrued over $300,000 in medical bills. In light of these numbers, the $200,000 is the final offer following mediation, the value of $100,000 short of covering Urban's medical bills for years, 4 years after the accident, was unreasonable. Furthermore, a panel of three judges awarded Urban roughly $1,420,679.13, which, including interest, which was in line with the Zurich prediction of the value of the case in 2017. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes